Dobry wieczór Państwu. Witamy na drugim wykładzie z cyklu odsłony wystawy głównej. Wystawa główna Muzeum Historii Żydów Polskich będzie uruchomiona w przyszłym roku, jednak już teraz jest obiektem zainteresowania innych instytucji, mediów, a przede wszystkim naszych zwiedzających. Wychodząc naprzeciw temu zainteresowaniu, postanowiliśmy przybliżyć Państwu zagadnienia związane z powstawaniem wystawy głównej, jak i treści, które na tej wystawie się pojawią, w formie wykładów otwartych. Co miesiąc będziemy prezentowali Państwu kolejne galerie wystawy głównej w porządku chronologicznym z perspektywy jej twórców, naukowców i kuratorów. 2 tygodnie temu rozpoczęliśmy nasz cykl podwójnym wykładem. Profesor Moshe Rossman z Uniwersytetu Bar-Ilan w Izraelu przedstawił swoją wizję tego, jak Muzeum Historii Żydów Polskich powinno funkcjonować, jaką tożsamość powinno obrać. Natomiast profesor Barbara Kirschenblatt-Gimblett z Uniwersytetu Nowojorskiego, główny kurator i dyrektor programowy wystawy głównej, przedstawiła metodologię pracy nad wystawą główną w trakcie jej powstawania. Dziś ponownie gościmy panią profesor Barbarę Kirschenblatt-Gimblett. Pani profesor, jak już powiedziałem, jest dyrektorem programowym i głównym kuratorem wystawy głównej. Jest profesorem Performance Studies na Uniwersytecie Nowojorskim. Jest autorką wielu tekstów poświęconych kulturze Żydów, wystawiennictwu i muzealnictwu. Dziś pani profesor przedstawi koncepcję galerii LAS, galerii, która będzie wprowadzała zwiedzających w przestrzeń wystawy głównej. Za chwilę oddam głos pani profesor, jednak już teraz pozwolę sobie skorzystać z okazji i zaprosić państwa na następny wykład z naszego cyklu 9 grudnia. Pani profesor Hanna Zaremska tu w tej sali o godzinie 18 przedstawi koncepcję galerii, średniowiecznej galerii Pierwsze spotkania. Oddaję głos pani profesor Barbarze Kirschenblatt-Gimblett.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Maciek. I want to thank Maciek Ugawa and Malgosia Stolarska for organizing these sessions. And I especially want to welcome children. I think it's the first time that we've had children attending one of our lectures, and I hope they won't be disappointed. I also would like to acknowledge Professor Hanna Zaremska and Professor Tadeusz Baranowski, who are here this evening. Hanna is our expert on the Medieval Gallery, and I really encourage you to come to her presentation of that gallery. It will be, I think, very, very interesting. But I want to extend a very warm welcome and a very deep debt of gratitude to Jerzy Halberstadt, who is the founding director of the museum, and who really is also the person responsible for the concept of the exhibition and for the master plan. And in that master plan, the idea of the forest was already there, although it has evolved, as I'll try and show you. And so a warm welcome to everybody. Just give me a moment here. Okay. And if you want to know how it happened that Jews in Germany suddenly fled in search of safety in Poland, legend has it, just a second here, just let me get organized. Legend has it that after they decreed a fast and beseeched God that he should save them from the hands of their murderers, there fell from heaven a slip of paper on which was written, "Go to Poland, and there you will find rest." The Jews set out for Poland, and when they arrived, birds in the forest greeted them. They chirped, "Poline, Poline." The travelers interpreted these sounds according to the Hebrew language, as if the birds wanted to tell them, "Here you should pass the night." And when they caught sight of the trees, it seemed to them that a page of the Gemara was hanging from every little branch. They understood at once that here a new place had been revealed to them where they could settle and continue to develop the Jewish spirit and age-old Jewish learning. Just a moment here. This forest and this story, in fact, this story is the inspiration for the gallery that will lead our visitors into this 1,000-year story. And the forest is very much inspired by the story. The forest is absolutely central to the story of how Jews came to Poland and why they stayed. This forest is a space of historical imagination. It's not an historical gallery. It's a poetic gallery. And as a poetic gallery, its task is to take our visitors from the world that they've just left and to immerse them in our story. We think of it as a priming experience. And what I want to share with you is how we imagine this in the master plan, because the master plan is quite clear about the forest as an idea. So let me just share this with you. This is from the master plan, and the master plan was created between 2000 and 2004. And here's what's written in the master plan. The master plan was created in collaboration with Event Communications, a multimedia narrative museum, exhibition company in London. And they worked very, very closely with historical experts here in Warsaw under the direction of Jerzy Halberstadt. The beginning of any museum is critical to its success. It is an area in which visitors can shed the complexities of modern living and prepare themselves for the visit ahead. It must start to involve visitors in the journey upon which they are embarking, establishing the language, the main characters, and the setting for the story that will unfold. The first gallery is Forest. It tells the story of the arrival of Jews in Polish lands. Now, in the master plan, there was not a distinction between legend and history. And what we've done is to make a very clear separation between the legends that Jews told themselves about why they came to Poland, how they came to Poland, and why they stayed. And we've made that a space of historical imagination. But when you leave the forest and you enter the medieval gallery, you cross a threshold between, if you will, historical imagination, between legend and history. And when history begins, it's a very, very different approach. So this is still the space of legend. This is now from the master plan. The informing image is a forest. Not a real forest, but an abstract, philosophical one, realized as simple timber uprights, in other words, tree trunks, which, combined with theatrical lighting, evoke the spirit of a forest. The forest represents a physical reality. At the time of the Jewish arrival, Poland was densely forested. And of course, we've taken our inspiration from Białowieża, the great primeval forest and UNESCO treasure. And that's our big inspiration. And these images are from Białowieża forest. So the forest represents a physical reality at the time of Jewish arrival. In other words, something primeval, something wild, a wilderness. And Poland was densely forested at that time. It also represents a common psychological landscape inhabited by memories shared by both Jews and Poles over 10 centuries. And what we've done with this forest is to, in a sense, fill it with the sound of the stories that Jews told themselves about how Poland got its name and how and why they came and stayed. And the most important story is the story of Pauline. And it's an astonishing story. And in fact, the word Pauline, in a sense, is the DNA, not only of the exhibition, but of the entire museum. Because if you look at those beautiful glass fins that coat the building, that are all around the outside of this building, you will see silk-screened on the glass the word Pauline in, if you will, Yiddish and Hebrew letters on the one hand and Latin letters on the other. And why is that story and why is that word so critically important to us? It's so critically important to us because what it says is that the stories that Jews told themselves were stories of coming to the right place, coming to a place where they could rest until the Messiah comes, coming to a place that would receive them, coming to a place where they could stay, and that they were escaping persecution and hardship in Western Europe, and they found a place where they could rest and stay here in Poland. And the moment of arrival to the forest and the sound, and the stories vary. There are some wonderful variations on these stories. One of them is that the cloud breaks and an angel's hand points from the cloud and points down and says, Pauline, rest here. Or another variation is that they saw words of the sacred text of the Talmud carved on the trees. Or another version is that pages of the Gemara, pages of sacred text, were floating down. And that these were, in a sense, divine signs that they were divinely ordained, divinely destined to settle here, that this would be a good place to be. Now, that is an extraordinary starting place for our story of 1,000 years. And these are stories that Jews told themselves. There are two other legends that we will feature in this area of the forest. They're of a very different nature, and I'm going to come to them at the end, because what I'd like to do now is to share with you the evolution of a design solution to this forest. This turns out to have been one of the most difficult of all of our galleries. It's perhaps the most difficult one to design, and for a whole variety of reasons. Not because a forest is a difficult idea to work with, but I'm going to show you in just a moment why it's so difficult and why we have worked with concepts that were given to us by event communication from the master plan, from literally the year 2000 to 2004, and then with Nigio Design International, a Polish company, which we turned to when it came to produce the exhibition. We wanted to produce it here in Poland with a Polish company. And then with yet another set of proposals from the architect of the building, because he was very concerned about what form this would take, and I'll show you why. And then finally, with a very interesting, very inventive design company here in Warsaw, a young company called Bad Design. And I'll take you as far through the process as I can. But what it will do is, when you come back and you eventually experience the forest itself, you won't be thinking about how we made it. But today, I'm going to show you how we made it. And it's like going to Universal Studios to the back lot. It's not the sort of thing you normally get to see. So let's see what the story is here. Just a second. Let's see why this doesn't turn. Okay. The first challenge is architecture. And why is it a challenge? Because this museum is very unusual, and I think it's a great strength of the museum that it was created from the inside out. In other words, quite often museums are created first the building, and after the building, then the exhibition. The Jewish Museum in Berlin actually had, I think it's a fabulous building. The issue of it communicating Holocaust and the putting of 2,000 years of the Jewish history of German Jews within a Holocaust architecture, this is something we can discuss. But the architecture, qua architecture, is really gorgeous. But it was empty for 2 years as they try to figure out what to put inside. And our situation is exactly the opposite. And that is that this, the concept for the exhibition was developed first, and then it was given, the master plan was given to the architects, and they were told to design a building that would be suitable for this exhibition. So when Event Communications conceived of the forest and they did the master plan, they proposed a forest that had nothing to do with the actual architecture. That had absolutely nothing to do with the actual architecture. But it was simply that this should be a kind of forest you should be able to put anywhere. However, let's have a look at the architecture. And what's critical here is that when you come into this building, you come from the entrance here, you cross a bridge. Now, you may not have noticed when you enter the building from the main entrance that what you're seeing down here and down here is the exhibition level. You actually can see the exhibition level from the bridge. And you see the beginning of the exhibition, which is the forest, and you see the end of the exhibition, which is the end of the post-war gallery. So you can actually see into the exhibition itself. The other thing to keep in mind is that when you have such an open space and the space of the building itself is very open, the acoustics present an enormous problem. There is a lot of sound. There's a sound of people talking, of kids coming in, of groups, of guides. There's a lot of sound. This is not an enclosed area. And most of our galleries are enclosed. The forest is not enclosed. So what does it look like? Let's have another look. You come and also let me give you a sense. So when you come across the bridge, you can see down. How do you get to it? When you come in the main building, you're going to come down a set of stairs, and those stairs continue, and those stairs will continue and continue, and they're very, 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 very grand. And they'll take you down two levels, and you'll have a very dramatic view of an open space, which will be the space of the forest. And when you get down there, this is now the empty space. It has not yet been installed. This is the entrance to the medieval gallery. You can actually see all the way up to the very top of the building, and you can see the bridge that you just crossed. And so you have here a space, a forest that's inside the modern architecture of Rainer Mahlamaki's building. And he's very interested in how this installation is going to sit within his building. In other words, it's not a black box like a theater that you can put anything in, and it's not a white cube like a gallery where you can hang anything up. You're actually in the space of the architecture of the building, and whatever you do there has to somehow or other be in a proper relationship to this architecture. So let's see how the various designers try to cope with this challenge. And in fact, the fact of the matter is for the most part, in the beginning, they didn't. And that was the problem. So first, let's go to the master plan. This is the way in the... Now, a master plan is really just a general idea. It's essentially a rough draft. And it sets out the general outline of what you can start from. But having started from there, we go to a next step and a next step and a next step. And each step, the concept gets more clear and more detailed. But in the case of the forest, the settling on the concept presented a huge challenge. Now, if you remember from the description in the master plan, the forest was to be a set of pillars, essentially tree trunks. There wasn't to be branches. There wasn't to be a canopy. It would be like lampposts, like a set of poles. And you have to ask yourself, it's one thing how that would be experienced when you're in the gallery. It's another thing how it would be experienced when you're on the bridge and you're looking down. What would you see when you look down? And so this is essentially what Event imagined. They imagined a very abstract space, these evocative, if you will, tree trunks that would have something carved on them, and the use of multimedia and light as a way of creating the feeling of a forest, of a dappled forest. But they're, so far as I can tell from the master plan, they hadn't gone as far as thinking about what the sound would be, and they hadn't gone as far as thinking about actually using the legends within the forest itself. So when they made a kind of a plan for how this might work as an installation, of course, they didn't have the building yet. So they were just speculating on how it might work, and they thought of it rather as a kind of a spiral that you would come in, and then you would make a transition and move into the medieval gallery. In fact, they thought of it as the entrance to the medieval gallery, but we've treated it, of course, the building has offered us an opportunity to treat it quite differently. Now, when they were thinking about the next step, which is to say they completed the scheme, master plan in 2004, and then after the museum was established as an institution in 2005, and after the first successful international architectural competition for a public building in Poland was completed in 2005, and we knew that we would have a building and what the building would be, in 2006, Event Communication went to the next stage. Okay, that's the master plan. We didn't know what kind of building. We didn't know what kind of a space. But now we have an idea, and we now have to, if you will, develop this idea for the space of the building. And they understood the space of the building to be coming down these stairs, turning, coming down another set of stairs, and that when you came down those stairs, when you came to this area, you would see this beautiful forest and nothing else. But of course, that's not the case. You'll see a lot more of the building itself. So how do designers work? Well, they've got to take inspiration from somewhere. So they took inspiration from the legend, they took inspiration from the idea of a forest, and they took inspiration from artists' installations that were, if you will, tree-based. And so you can see here that they identify, this is actually a wonderful installation by an Iranian filmmaker that was done in London, but they create what they call mood boards to show a range of pre-existing design solutions and images that are a kind of inspiration. And one of the first iterations that they gave us was something like this. Now, What can I say? You'll have to see as we go along what this how this evolved. Essentially, the idea here was this: we would use the floor. These letters could be cut out. There, we could use some iconography, but essentially these would be tree trunks, not real logs, but probably made of a synthetic material, and there would be projection, if you will, of canopy and leaves. But what you don't see here is how this actually sits inside the building, because you have to imagine that since this space goes all the way from the floor to the roof, up several stories in the building, and when you're standing on the bridge, when you look down, you're going to be seeing the tops, the round tops of these poles. And the architect wasn't happy about it. The architect felt that this kind of installation solution was completely contrary to the contemporary, minimalist, organic architecture of the building. And he, in other words, he was not happy with us treating the space of the building as just another gallery and putting something in it from his perspective. So what happened next? Next, the idea was this. We're not happy with visitors looking down onto these tops of these tree trunks. And so Arnaud Deschelle, one of the really gifted event designers, came up with a solution using laser-cut steel that would provide a canopy so that visitors would have a partial view below, but they wouldn't be able to see all the way down. And the advantage of the canopy would be that it might be possible to contain the sound, to control the acoustics of the space, because sound, we thought, would be very, very important. And he had a number of ideas for how to do this, but this shows you the relationship between being on the bridge and looking down into the forest, and not only in the forest and looking up. Because for many of us, for myself, and I think also for the architect, this was a very important factor. You could not overlook the two views from above and from below. And so Arnaud came up with a very, very interesting proposal. And his proposal was to take a map of Poland and, in a sense, to turn it upside down, put it up as the organizing principle of the canopy, and to organize our three legends that we wanted to tell beneath it, and to do so taking inspiration from, if you will, visual material of a variety of kinds, taking inspiration from paper cuts, because he's very interested. He loves what he calls laser-cut steel, where you can get very, very fine, very lacy patterns. So he thought that would be interesting. He wanted to take inspiration from Jewish texts and print and calligraphy, but also from historical images and, if you will, title pages and a variety. In other words, this is a game from trees that are carved. This is a game what you would call a mood board. And then the final, if you will, the ultimate expression of all of those ideas looked something like this. And the architect was not happy. From the architect's point of view, this had nothing to do with the aesthetic and style and space of his building. And although I think really it had, I still think it has huge potential, and he had the idea of cutting out letters here and having them project on the floor, but you can see that this is a very strong architectural space, and what you're not seeing is how it functions in relationship to everything above it and beyond it. So this presented us with a dilemma, what we were going to do. And then when you're there in the space itself, of course, it would feel very, very, very different. But this seemed to be not acceptable. And I want to give you a sense also of what the space is like when you look at it architecturally. So you come down these stairs, which are actually quite dramatic and really big. And when you come down, this space is quite high. This is the bridge. This space is quite high. And then, this is the bridge here. Let's see. And the space comes low and goes up high again. And he imagined that some of these trees and some of these canopy elements, some would be lower, some would be higher. But this is what it would look like, if you will, from a cross-section. And it gives you a little bit of a sense of the challenge of the space, because this space goes all the way up to the roof of the building. We completed the process of what they call, so we did master plan, and that you saw the original plan proposal from Event. Scheme design, you saw what Arnaud Deschelle from Event created for scheme design, much more detailed, much more, if you will, resolved. And then there was something called, this in fact was the last stage of detail design, which is another stage. And then we had to go into production, and we had to then review what we had to see what was feasible, how much it would cost, and whether we could make the architect happy, which I have to tell you is not easy. So when we turned to Nigio Design International, they looked at all our material, and they made their proposals. And there were many of them. I'm not going to share all of them with you, but just to give you a taste of the way in which designers try to deal with the challenge of creating a design solution in a very difficult situation. So one of the things that Reynu Mahlamaki did not like, well, first of all, laser cut steel is very expensive, very, very, very heavy. And actually, it's not great from an acoustic point of view because it's a very hard material and the sound bounces off it. So Reynu wanted something that was basically like mesh, that was something open and where you could actually hide the sound, you could hide the speakers, you could hide the light, you could hide all the technology inside this mesh structure, and that we would be able to project onto the walls and project or if you will, print or carve onto the trees and create some kind of an environment like this. But this also did not make the architect happy. And this is another view of it. And there was all kinds of issues as to how dense this net would be, how it would be created, what it would be made out of, and the way in which it could be used to cast shadows on the floor. But these poles don't articulate very well with this net, and the whole effect is a little bit strange. So we ourselves were not particularly happy with it. And the idea was that from the bridge, the solution would be something rather smooth that would create a space between this layer and that layer, and then inside it, there would be the technology. But you get a little bit of a sense of how it would work, because always how it would work from the bridge was important. And when all those solutions didn't seem to be working, Nigio proposed yet another solution, nothing except projection. And the idea here was that simply using this kind of net-like material and creating, if you will, trees made of light and projections on the wall to create this kind of a multimedia environment. But this took us quite a long way from what we had in mind, and we didn't pursue it. So what did the architect propose? What did Reynu Mahlamaki propose? Well, he proposed a variety of things. I'm only showing you a fraction of them. But they're very Reynu, I would put it, very Reynu. But they're really different from what he did in the building itself. But in good faith, he tried very hard to work with the brief, which is it had to be a forest of some kind. So this is one of his proposals, just a second. Whoops. Okay, so he had said, okay, why don't we create some kind of a mesh kind of thing and make everything out of mesh, including the trees, and make it a really artistic installation that is quite abstract and quite distant from anything realistic, no tree trunks, no cement, nothing heavy, no laser cut steel, something quite light. And this shows you a little bit how he saw it sitting. In other words, he didn't want to deal with this space at all. He wanted to take the space that's actually really open and quite high, and he wanted to create this kind of an effect, and you can see the scale of it, which is actually quite clever because scale here is everything. When you've got a building that goes this high, scale is everything. And this is a little bit of what it would look like in some kind of a mesh formation. And then he created actually several other iterations of this approach, using the idea of mesh, and some of them actually quite elaborate and quite radical, and they were not proposals that we felt could properly communicate and carry what it was that we were wanting to communicate. So our final resolution, which I'm not going to show you, you're going to have to come and see it, is a solution that was proposed by Bad Design. And I would say that the architect, Reynu, And he's really a good spirit and wanting very, very much to work with us to find a good solution. I think we're okay. We have to make some modifications. But let me tell you basically the approach. The approach is to forget about tree trunks, for starters. Forget about big, huge mesh things. And to go rather with a set of very, very large glass panels and the projection of film, multimedia, of those beautiful forests, those kind of beautiful forest images. And we're working, Arik Dibble is here today. He is our creative director for multimedia. And we think we can do something very minimalist, very, if you will, aesthetically beautiful, very evocative, that combines, I would say, in a sense, even realistic forest material in a very poetic environment. But one critical thing for us is the sound that will carry the legends. And of course, the first legend and the legend that inspires the forest itself is the Pauline legend. But there are two other legends that we wish to feature. We have, if you will, three legend areas. And the two other legends are the legend of Esterka and Kazimierz the Great and what we call legends of arrival. And they're very interesting. Pauline is obvious because it's a legend literally of coming from one place, arriving here, and staying. But Esterka is for us also a legend, if you will, of origins in the sense that it's a legend that Jews told themselves, but not only Jews. In fact, the earliest version of this legend is in the Chronicle of Dwugosz from the 15th century. And the earliest Jewish version of the legend is in the work of David Ganz in Tzemach David, in Hebrew, and shortly thereafter in Yiddish. So we have in the, if you will, the Polish version, the Dwugosz version, Esterka is a mistress. But in the Jewish version, she's a wife. So you can see that there's a difference in these versions. So let's have a look at these two stories and think for a moment about what they offer our visitors in terms of this entrance experience where we have the liberty, because it's a space of historical imagination, where we have the liberty of working with legend. And I think legend is, a sense, folk imagination. And it gives us something that we're not free to do when we stick to our historical narrative. So we're going to turn to two very, very short versions, but they're really early versions of our Esther legends. And we'll start with the Dwugosz version in the Annal in the 15th century. And I should say that what's really interesting about this it also is that we include it in the medieval gallery. But when we include it in the medieval gallery, it functions in a very, very different way. And that's something I think Hannah will probably talk about next time. So first, what I'll do is let me go back for a moment and start with the Dwugosz. And the Dwugosz goes something like this. Kazimierz, king of Poland, took as a concubine a Jewish woman, Esterka, on account of her unusual beauty. He even had two sons by her. At her request, he issued exceptional privileges and freedoms to all Jews living in the Polish kingdom. So what's interesting here, and this is how it functions in the medieval gallery, is that it's an attempt to account for how come the ruler of the country gave Jews the conditions that made it possible for them to settle and to live and to become, eventually, the largest Jewish community in the world and a center of the Ashkenazi Jewish world. How did that happen? It could not have happened without the conditions in a statute or charter or what was called a privilegium. And it's, in a sense, you could say that it was baffling. How come? And in this case, the explanation is not that Jews were economically useful to the ruler. The explanation is this beautiful Esterka, so beloved by Kazimierz, that he would give Jews these very special circumstances. Now, how does David Ganz, in the Jewish version, how does he narrate? So what David Ganz, let me see if I have the David Ganz here, or if I have, just a moment, where do I have it? I have, yes, okay, just a second. And the story goes something like this. Israelites came to Poland, a wild and desolate land, empty of luxuries and of gold and silver. They brought with them all kinds of goods in whole heaps, they reached an agreement with the dukes and princes and counselors of Krakow, for in those days there was no king in Poland, but 12 voyevods, and they accepted the Jews, showed them everything, and also borrowed 30 million in gold from them. And so this is a story, if you will, that focuses more on the economic basis for Jewish settlement and for their arrival. Now, for the David Gans, the Tzemach David, Kazimierz, king of Poland, took for himself a mistress, a Jewish girl named Esther, so beautiful that there was no girl like her in the whole country. She was to him as a wife for a long time, and the king did good towards the Jews for her sake. She made him issue privileges and freedoms to the Jews. So that's David Gans. The other, I'll explain in a moment what the other version is. That's David Gans. There's also a very, very beautiful version of the story by Agnon, in which he, I would say, because what happens is that modern Hebrew and Yiddish writers in the 19th and 20th century were very fascinated by these stories. These stories actually sparked a literary imagination, and they created literary versions of these stories. And in the Agnon version of the Esther story, he says that the king loved her so much that when she died, he was inconsolable, and that he buried her body in one place, and he buried her eyes and her heart near the castle, and that she would come out at night, the ghost would come out at night looking for her eyes and her heart. And it's a very, very beautiful story, but it's a lovely example of the way in which the story captures the literary imagination of contemporary Hebrew and Yiddish writers. Now, of course, this story was a favorite story in 19th century, basically Polish historical and romantic painting. And I think that it was particularly appealing to, if you will, both Poles and Jews who were committed to integration. And we have a whole section of the 19th century gallery on what we call integrationism and on Poles of the Mosaic faith and their identification with Polish national struggle. And at the same time, stories, and we'll look at some of them now, and paintings that communicate, if you will, the a kind of historical perspective on Jews being an integral part of this history. And so these are just a few examples of the many examples of paintings, particularly from the 19th century, of Esterka, of the ruin in Kazimierz, and just one second here. Her father wasn't too thrilled about this relationship. And my father's painting. Because my father was born in Opatów in 1934, and he left, in 1916, and he left Opatów in 1934 when he was 17. And when he was 73 in 1990, he began to paint what he could remember, and he is, if you will, a Jewish Nikifor. He is a self-taught painter. He's like a naive artist. And one of the things he remembers is a school trip to a big oak tree that he was told was where Esterka and Kazimierz would sit. And so he painted it as he imagined it. And what it means is that in the Polish schools, and certainly before the war, Polish school children are told this story, and they themselves have a kind of imagination of what was it like. So here he's got a knight on a horse, and he's got the Esterka and Kazimierz, and it looks like quite a nice alfresco affair under this enormous oak tree, which he told me was the biggest oak tree. It was some enormous, huge oak tree. So we now have the Pauline legend, which is one of the legends we want to tell. We have the Esterka and Kazimierz legend and all the variations on it. And then we have these, what I call, legends of arrival. And they're really very interesting. The one that I read just a moment ago about Jews arriving with jewels and money and being of economic value really belongs here. And just one second, let me just see that I have everything. It's this one here, yes. And the one that I just read you actually comes from Dov Ber Birkenthal, or Ber of Bolochov, who lived in the 18th century, and who, in a work called Divrei Bina, actually wrote about how Jews came and why they stayed, and he presents it as an economic story. But well, he might, because who was he? He was a wine importer, and he's an amazing person. he would basically take vodka, or he would take goods from essentially the Commonwealth. He would take them to Hungary, and he would come back with Tokaj wine, and he would sell it in Poland. He'd sell it to the church. He'd sell it to the nobility. And he left a memoir at the end of the 18th century. And in that memoir, it's not a normal memoir. It's not a normal autobiography. Essentially, it's a story of all of his economic exploits and conquests. He was so proud every deal that he made that he tells the story of one deal after another. So it would be very natural that he would understand the story of why Jews came and why they stayed in completely economic terms. And so it's completely compatible with who he was. I mean, just to give you an example, he was on his way back from Hungary with a huge shipment of wine in a wagon with horses that he had to rent, because the horses that he rode to Hungary he sold. So he hired a wagon and horses, put the wine in it, went and stayed at an inn overnight, and robbers came and robbed him. And he said he found his driver out in the field somewhere wounded, but he said the wine was intact. Everything was fine. So this is a man with economics on his mind, and his story is absolutely a story of economics. And so let's have a look at the stories of arrival. And they, of course, are very interesting, and they are really matched by the great romantic historical paintings of Jan Matejko and other 19th century artists. So let me start with I'm going to really present to you two stories. And they're wonderful because they're 19th century stories. You could say that they are, if you will, apologetic. Moshe Rossman, who spoke last time, a wonderful, wonderful lecture, very inspiring, he characterized this scene of arrival as, if you will, Jews supplicating, in a sense, begging the king to accept them, and that it was a kind of noblesse oblige that they would be taken in. And, of course, it's a very 19th century view of this story, as are the legends that are told. And so the first version that I want to share with you is based on an anonymous text from the 19th century that first appeared in the German language. And these are stories that appear in the Jewish press, but also in the Polish press. And so here's the first one. The main place from which these wandering groups of Jews came to Poland was Germany. They sent a deputation to Leszek in the year 893 in Gniezno to set forth their oppression and misery and to beseech him, to allow them to enter within the boundaries of his dominions. King Leszek asked, "What religion do the Israelites have?" The Jews answered, "They believe in an invisible, eternal, omnipotent, indivisible being who created everything and holds everything in existence." King Leszek asked, "Do they feel themselves responsible before God when they do wrong to others?" The Jews answered, "Without a doubt, the smallest injury against mankind will be rebuked." King Leszek asked, "If there is any who differs in his opinions, is he regarded as a man?" The Jews answered, "Everything that thinks and talks is a man and is to be regarded as a man." King Leszek asked, "Is there aught of tolerance in your law?" And the Jews answered, "Many and numerous, if we may, we shall quote these words, 'Thou shalt neither vex a stranger nor oppress him, for ye were strangers in the land of Egypt.'" Exodus 22:21. King Leszek assured them that he was right glad to see them in his kingdom. And the next year, in 894, a numerous throng of Israel entered from German lands into Poland. Very nice, very romantic, very 19th century, very consistent with our integrationist story, all these stories that, if you will, are stories about the welcoming, the arrival, and the integration of Jews. But also, it's a story in which Jews present themselves as having high ethical values. And now, let's turn it around in the second version, where it's not the king that is asking the Jews, but rather the Jews that are asking the king. And this version is after a version by Marek Dubs that appeared in Uchenko in 1861. And these are really Polish Jewish integrationist journals and publications. It was from Germany, so relates the folk tradition, that the Jews came to Poland. The newly arrived community wanted to ask three questions. We are going to meet a new people. Let us endeavor to be accepted by them. And even more, by living exemplary lives of labor and modesty, we can acquire the inhabitants' friendship. So the first emissary of the Jews went to the representative of the ruler and asked, "Will you murder us? We believe in God, who created the heaven and the earth." "The nobles of Poland are not murderers," replied the old grandee. The second representative of the Jewish delegation asked, "Will you rob us?" And the old man answered, "The nobles of Poland are not brigands." The third emissary of the Jews asked, "Will you allow us to settle among you?" And the honest old man answered, "The nobles of Poland practice hospitality towards strangers." The next day, the small community settled down in peace and freedom among the Polish people. So these are really very much 19th century legends, and they are matched by these kinds of very romantic paintings. This is a detail of that larger painting, and here is yet another one. So these three legends are the legends, and we can have the lights up now, if we may. These three legends are the legends that we would like somehow to communicate in the space of the forest. The most important, as I said earlier, is the legend of Pauline, but the other legends really take us forward. They take us forward in time, and they take us forward in terms of a certain kind of mentalité that is rooted in the time in which the legend itself was being told. These legends tell us more about those telling them than they do about history. And so these 19th century legends, we in a sense come back to them in the 19th century when we look at this issue of integration and the way it is configured both by the Jews that are integrating and the Poles that are receiving them. And it's so with this space of historical imagination and with these legends that we want to prime our visitors for the thousand-year story that will follow, and that when they cross that threshold, that threshold between the forest, a space of historical imagination, and the medieval gallery, an historical gallery, when they cross that threshold, they will cross the threshold between legend and history, and they will then embark on this thousand-year story. So you'll have to come back and experience it. That's all I can tell you. So that's what we're that's basically what we have in mind for the forest.
Dziękujemy za ten piękny wykład. Mamy czas na zadawanie pytań.
Barbara, I will add a little thing about the designers. This is there's a very nice set of creative company called 180 Heartbeats and Band Design,
right,
which is we need to mention them. It's excellent collaboration because there's a creative team and space specialists, and this is how it worked quite well. So we are so
absolutely
happy.
Thank you. That's important to note. Absolutely. So.
Jakieś pytania? So I have a question, Barbara.
Thank you. Thank goodness.
We know that this is the first gallery, the first gallery that will make people enter the very space of the exhibition. But we also know that there is a closing gallery, which is called, well, post-1989, let's call it an installation, right? And these two areas, these two spaces, neighbor each other. Do you imagine both of those spaces as some kind of bookmarks? Would you identify methods of exhibiting or narration in two of those neighboring areas, starting and the end?
Well, actually, it's a great point because, in another sort of longer version of this presentation, I would present the dilemma of what to do with the other part of the space, which is in fact the end of the exhibition. In other words, when you enter the forest and go from the forest to the medieval gallery, you go really in a circle all the way through the story, and then you come out the other side. When you come out the other side, you're on the back of the forest. In fact, let me just see if I can show that to you from a... Just a moment. Let's see. Oh, just a moment. Let me see if I can... I'd like to show you. But basically, maybe I'll just explain it. Basically, when you come across the bridge, as I indicated, on one side you look down, you see the forest, and on the other side you look down in the other direction, and you will see the end of the exhibition, what we call post-89.
Yeah.
And in the early iterations, the forest was visible from both sides. And so it was a very interesting question whether to work with that or work against it. So what did we think about in working with it? One of the ways to work with it, we thought, was to actually come back to the forest. It was an early idea of Steve Simons, who was the senior designer at Vent Communications. He had the idea to create, I wouldn't call it a glass wall, but some kind of a membrane that would give you the feeling of the forest, but a green forest, not an abstract forest, that would be a kind of living forest of our moment, of the present moment. But there were a lot of there was a lot of discomfort because the forest has a lot of associations in terms of the history of Polish Jews. On the one hand, it's this primeval place of the story of Poline, but the other hand, it's got really strong associations with the Holocaust and with all the killings in forests. And so there was a kind of ambivalence about a forest somehow or other returning at the end, because when you come back to it at the very end, it's not the primeval forest that you had at the beginning. So we weren't so thrilled about that. But then, interestingly, Nigio thought, well, maybe we could do something really radical. And he, and I you know, there are just too many proposals to present all of them to you, but he actually came up with a proposal to plant live trees in the post-89, so that you had, you know, concrete tree stumps or whatever it was you had in the poetic forest, but in post-89, you'd have a park. You'd actually have trees in pots, and they'd be growing, and it's got natural light. And then we thought, well, that's a bit too much. So then he thought, maybe we'll have one tree, and it will be symbolic of a seedling that grows into a mighty oak, something along those lines. Then we decided that was really not the way to go. And there were a number of other proposals. So finally, I think we decided that once we go with a completely different concept, and there are no tree trunks, and there are no canopy, and there's nothing like that, that we would essentially find a design solution that was in the same design language for both post-89 and the forest, but without any reference to the forest as iconography or as story or as content. And so it's one designer coming up with a design solution for the entire space for both the end and the beginning, and whether visitors will really remember the beginning when they come to the end remains to be seen, but it's more coherent, and it's especially more coherent because visitors can see both of them from the bridge. From the bridge, they're going to be able to see both at the same time, and that was something that the architect was very concerned about, that there'd be something coherent between the two parts as well as with the architecture. Mm-hmm. So it was an interesting issue.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Oh, good. We've got some questions. Thank God.
Hi. The conception of an historical gallery creates an expectation generally of receiving information from various periods. And this idea of a poetic gallery creates the possibility, in my mind anyway, of a space where visitors have the opportunity to interact and to be more active rather than sort of passive receivers of information. And I'm wondering if this is part of what's gone into the thinking about creating these spaces as poetic spaces rather than as historical spaces throughout?
Well, actually, we have we're doing what you're asking for, but the opposite way. And what I mean is this. This is a poetic space. It's not a place to explore. It's a place to experience. And so the poetry of it should be, the only way to keep it really poetic is to make it very much of a multi-sensory experience, and for it to activate the imagination activate feeling and activate the senses. That's the key to it working. So it's much more like an artistic installation, and it's not about really imparting information or communicating anything very extensive. What is important is to convey the essence of these stories, especially, most importantly, the Pauline story. But the historical galleries are not passive. That's where all the interactivity is. That's where all the action is, because the entire exhibition is predicated on the idea of exploration, and it's predicated on the idea of an active learner, not of an exhibition that teaches. So it's not about teaching, imparting, inculcating, instructing. It's not the style. It's not the pedagogy of this exhibition. It's rather about exploring in a very well-structured, carefully curated environment that offers a, if you will, a set of conditions that are completely different from any other medium. As a medium, this is completely different from a book, from a film, from sitting at a computer at home, from a video game, completely different. And so anything that you do in the space of the exhibition in these historical galleries is conditioned by the total environment that's been created, and that whole environment is communicating. There's nothing in that gallery that's not communicating, right down to the furniture. And so it's a very active, very dynamic environment, and it works, first of all, it works without a visitor having to do anything. It just works by being in the space. And then when a visitor, if you will, moves towards exploring or paying attention, more close focus, it works in yet another way. But there's interactivity, and there's all kinds of things to explore. Some are manual, some are digital. And the exhibition itself encourages reflection because it's not in one voice. It's a multi-voiced exhibition. So there are multiple voices, and the voices are, as much as possible, coming from the period, so that you have the feeling that you're hearing people from the period, memoirs, letters, autobiographies, contracts, legal documents, rabbinical responsa, novels, poetry, that you have a kind of immediacy and direct contact with the period and with those who are speaking and writing in the period. So it's a very, very special, very particular way of narrating and a particular way of creating a very dynamic environment that is working for visitors who have very different learning styles. Some come and they want to see objects. Others are interested in media. Kids might go straight to the interactivity. Somebody else wants to read because they can control the rate at which they take in the information. Others just want to really absorb it. They want to browse. They just want to feel it. So it's the art of creating such an exhibition is doing so as to accommodate young visitors, kids, older visitors, visitors who know something, visitors who know nothing. So it's I would say we very much are with what you're asking for, but in reverse. This is Hanna Zaremska. Bring the mic up.
Rather, okay. Some comments and reflections. What I am thinking about is appreciating the idea. I mean, there are some things which I like a lot, even if they are not said in direct way. So the first thing is that from the beginning we are putting our heroes in their shoes. I mean that it's Jewish voice. So Jewish voice about what, actually, what should be said, or is said, I hope. A legend is a story of about somebody's identity. And simply this. So I don't like the idea to put Dlugacz in the story. Because first of all, Dlugacz's text was written in a very complicated political circumstances. It means a conflict about Jewish privileges from the 15th century. So really you can get rid of it because it's an exception for this period. You show, let's say, Polish, Latin, whatever text, which is not a Jewish text. What is important, and it's only for a note, that the text, because we don't know, it can be that the Dlugacz's text was inspired by already existing Jewish stories. So it's not a place to Putin. Let's say it would be a good idea to have only Jewish version, because we don't, you don't need Lubash here. We have Lubash. I have Lubash, of course, but I have Lubash in the chapter about the violence. So it's completely as a representative of Polish church. So
yes,
it's
and
you put Lubash here, it was really a representative of Polish church, of the attitude of the Polish. I think that you don't need it. And I'm coming back to a general reflection, so legend as a story about somebody's identity. So you present, let's say, what Jews were thinking about their identity, what they are talking about, that they are newcomers, that they came before, that it's a strange place for them, a new place for them. And what is really, I think, but I am not sure for the idea, as far as the idea is concerned. I mean that actually you are talking in the first part, at least, of your lecture, so about Jews as a newcomers. And in the second part, with the change, you are talking about integration.
Acceptance.
So, okay. But something more.
Yeah.
So I would be very interested how you show what seems to me the most interesting for, let's say, to show to visitors that in a way they are in the same situation, they are coming from outside, and the story begins, let's say, and for Jews, what it's exactly a kind of reflection. It's exactly very interesting fact that they were so linked to the idea that they were newcomers.
Yes.
It's doesn't matter integration, acceptance, whatever. That they, from till the end, they are stressing. After, I don't know, 10 centuries of the presence in Poland, they remain still newcomers, and in Polish painting, what we see is doesn't matter, Bolesław Chrobry, Mieszko Pierwszy, accepting them after 10 centuries. So if you are thinking about the United States, so it's the only idea, I think it would be really good to get rid of the Lubash.
Thank you. No, I appreciate it. And also, the fact of the matter is that we tell the story of Esterka and Kazimierz in your gallery in one of the big arcades, the story of privileges. So the story is there. It's not as if the story is not already in the exhibition. So it's already there. But it's a great point. But thank you very, very much. Thank you.
Czy mają Państwo jeszcze jakieś pytania? Można zadawać pytania też po polsku.
Po polsku też.
Were there any other stories, any other legends that you were thinking about and you decided not to include?
Yes, actually. I think that, in fact, the Pauline legend is the great one. It's really the great one. But it's one of many, many place name legends. And so what we find is, and there's Chaya Bar Yitzchak is a scholar that's written a book on the Jewish legends of Poland. And she looked specifically at the stories Jews told themselves about how Polish places got their names. But usually it's the Jewish version of the Polish name. So for all the places in Poland that have Polish names, there are Jewish names. Sometimes they sound like, for example, Kazimierz is Kuzmir. Opatów is Apt. I can give you many, many other examples. So they and there are what you might call their place name legends. There are legends about how places got their names. And there are also similar stories about synagogues. And what's interesting about them is that it's a way of saying that we belong here and that these places have these names that are connected to our stories and to our texts and to who we are. And so I actually have some very beautiful ones, but it went beyond what the forest could hold. So we're not using them. But I think for educators, it'd be great. In fact, it would be wonderful to collect these place name legends. And I don't think we have them for everywhere in Poland, but we have them for enough places that it's an interesting question as to, in any given place, is there, what is the Jewish name of the place? And is there a place name legend, a legend about how the place got its name or what the name means? But there were lots of them, actually, lots. Those were the other ones that I was interested in. And there are lots of versions of the Esterka legend and lots of versions of these legends of acceptance. So we only picked a couple of them to share. And they're in Yiddish, in Hebrew, in Polish, in German. They're in multiple languages. And we'd like actually visitors to hear the original language. I think that would really be great. So any other questions? Don't be shy.
Jest pytanie.
Ja chciałam zapytać o sens eksponowania tych legend na wejściu i być może w ogóle w muzeum. Ponieważ to są takie legendy, którymi Żydzi byli knebdowani w Polsce, kiedy się upominali o równe prawa. I choćby nie wiem, ile wieków mieszkali w Polsce, stale przypominało im się, że są przybyszami. W sytuacji, kiedy w momencie, kiedy dotarli do Polski, też właściwie nie było Polaków w Polsce. Tak? To była zupełnie inna sytuacja w sensie, prawda, grup zamieszkujących terytorium i relacji, właściwie też postaci państwa, królestwa, tak, autorytetu króla, autorytetu kościoła. To była zupełnie inna sytuacja. A rozumiemy to dzisiaj w takich kategoriach, że była jakaś Polska, jacyś Polacy, prawda, którzy przyjęli tych Żydów z tym przysłowiowym królem, królem Kazimierzem Wielkim. Prawda? I na przykład nie szokuje nas informacja dzisiaj w Polsce, że Żydzi byli w Europie jeszcze przed Słowianami.
So if I may interfere. So the question is about the sense of presenting the legends, which for many centuries were part of persecution rather than of persecution of Jews rather than presenting the very story of their existence in Poland, of their presence in Poland, especially given the fact that at that time when Jews came to Poland, there was no Polish state, which if I understand correctly, and no, or Poles as a ethnic group.
No, it's actually a great question. I would say this, that because we treat this as a poetic space of historical imagination, we are able to take liberties that we couldn't take if we were to take a strictly historical approach. But everything that you're asking for is in the historical narrative of the galleries that follow. But in this case, this is very much what Hannah expressed. And that is that this, if you will, there's going to be plenty of bad news in the galleries that follow. There's going to be pogroms and blood libels. There's going to be host desecration, and there's going to be riots and tumults, and there's going to be Khmelnytsky uprising, and there's going to be Holocaust, and there's going to be anti-Semitism, there's going to be lots of bad news. And we don't have to, if you will, in a sense, balance the good news with the bad news in the forest. That's not our task. Our task in the forest, our major task in the forest, is to create what we would call a priming experience, an experience that will separate our visitors from the cloakroom and from the world outside, and put them in a new mood, in a mood, a kind of not clearly defined mood, but a mood that, in a sense, triggers their own historical imagination and prepares them to enter this historical narrative. That's the task. That is the task. And as a result, these are the stories. First of all, we can't tell very many stories in this space. We have to keep them short. The ones that I offered you about arrival, they are 10 or 15 times longer than this very, very shortened version that we're using. They're much, much, much longer. They actually carry in them some of the themes that you've mentioned. They ask, will you rob us? Will you murder us? So you actually have in that dialogue already some of the anxiety and the fear on the part of the ruler in relation to the Jews and the Jews in relation to the ruler. It's already there in those dialogues. But these are stories that, if you will, they offer a frame that I think is a better frame for holding this thousand-year story than anything else I can think of. And all the rest of it, all of the horrible stuff, it comes next, so to speak. So we wouldn't, in the forest, that's not the purpose, that's not the way the forest will function. The forest functions, it's poetry. It's imagination. It's legend. It's something else. It is something else. And I actually think that starting it that way is completely counterintuitive, because we're sitting on a site of genocide. We're sitting on the site of the Warsaw Ghetto. We're facing the monument of the Warsaw Ghetto heroes. The Holocaust is an overwhelming presence. And I think it's completely counterintuitive to start this story with legends of belonging, with legends that say we came here and belong here. The rest will come. It'll come in the historical narrative. But it's completely counterintuitive to start this journey, if you will, in that way. And I think it's really, I think it's the right thing to do. I think that in the master plan, the concept that event developed with the Polish team was absolutely right on the money. I think it was really the right way to go. They didn't quite develop it in content terms the way that we did, but they were definitely on the right track from my point of view. Any other comments?
Okay, teraz something came to my mind.
Oh, thanks.
It's only to not to discuss a comment. It came to my mind how sophisticated was Agnon's analysis of the word Pauline.
Yes.
I mean, it's very deep set in Jewish culture. This playing with letters, with words, with sense. And of course, it exists also in other cultures. I mean, Vars and Sava makes Warszawa. but it's simple. And here it's really a word, it's a noun, it's very deeply set in Jewish, Hebrew, linguistic culture.
Absolutely. I think that's the power of it is that it's Polish, really, it's Hebrew, it's Yiddish.
It's really strong.
Absolutely. I that's going to be our strongest element in shaping this. Absolutely. Absolutely.
What's the comment? I didn't understand your point about the life tree at the end of the exhibition. Actually, I really like idea. It's like when you have the multimedia exhibition, when everything is kind of artificial, and the end you have the life tree, the living tree, that would be wonderful symbol of revival of the Jewish community in Poland.
That was the idea. That was exactly it. And you know, we actually seriously considered it. It was the idea. I think the challenge, and that's another whole lecture, is the challenge of how to deal with the space at the very end. I mean, think of it this way. You go through, you have this beautiful forest, you go through this whole thousand-year exhibition, and you come to the end of it, the end of the narration, not the end of the story, but the end of the telling of the story in the museum, not the end of the story. And when you come to the very, quote, end, it's the period post-89. And it turns out that the space for post-89 is actually quite small. But the content that we would like to communicate is very rich and very, very deep. And it's also very architectural, that you really feel the architecture of the building in that space. So we're really limited, especially given the architect's
concern that we not that we do something that will sit properly in that space. So when we considered the live tree, and it was really seriously considered, and we felt exactly as you do, that it was a symbol of the renewal on a small scale. It was one tree, not thousands, not millions. It was one tree. But when we tried to actually organize the exhibition around it, it really was really difficult. It wasn't working. It just wasn't working. And the other thing is we thought it was too literal, that maybe it was too literal, maybe a little pathetic. So we went for something else. But actually, we gave it serious, serious consideration exactly for that reason. And what's interesting is, for whom does it really resonate? Because I think it resonated very much for the scholars responsible for the post-war gallery are Helena Dattner and Stasia Krajewski. And I think it resonated very much for them as well. So it may be just a difference in sensibility in the various various of us who had to make a decision about it. But it's interesting that you feel strongly about it too, because there was support for it. There was support. There really was. Any other?
Yeah, I'd like to ask about the possibilities of a critical framing of the stories that are kind of intended to, as you express it, to bring people from the cloakroom into the gallery space, because as I understood, you're using this kind of integrationist the stories that are brought for the integrationist period of so-called storytelling, the framework which as we know did fail in 19th century,
yeah.
And it ended at one point, and as a political movement, as a social movement, it did not proceed into what we call a full modernity. So, and these are all stories we know because these stories, as they are brought from 19th century, they are not brought from 10th century.
Right.
These are stories that we know, and these are stories that resonate in our kind of cultural background that we bring to the gallery, also from the cloakroom. So my question is that if we're presented with these stories, just at the entrance, is there any possibility of the critical reading for...
The critical reading is the end of poetry. So, okay, let me come at it this way. The critical element we bring in the 19th century gallery when we deal with the integrationists. That's where it happens. You can't, let me put it this way, you can't do everything everywhere, even if you wanted to. And here, the intention is that this is not an experience that will last very long. You know, we want our visitors to actually get into the historical gallery, so it's a priming experience, and it's not intended to go into detail, into depth, to explain, to say who the various narrators are, what Yushchenko is, etc. It doesn't work that way at all. It's absolutely intended to be it has to do with historical imagination, period, Kropka. And when you get to the 19th century gallery, then we deal with the integrationist story full on. And that means we deal with integration as a social and cultural process. We deal with integrationism as a project. We deal with the, if you will, the golden moment of it, the Polish-Jewish Brotherhood, the uprising, and all the hope. We deal with the shattering of that hope with the December pogrom and other events, rise of ethno-nationalism, modern forms of anti-Semitism, etc. And also, we don't treat it the integrationist dream, as we call it, as something that ends. It may end as a project, but it actually continues as an aspiration. And we take it all the way through. We don't sort of stop it in, 20, 30 years after its heyday. We actually see it, and we actually see it also as a, if you will, aspiration in the 20th century, in the interwar years. And so the issue of the process and the project, and we distinguish them. The project had a platform. It had journals. It had the Tlamatsky Synagogue. It had a certain kind of, a coalescence
where it was able to articulate its program, so to speak. The process is a much wider and broader phenomenon. And so, and we distinguish them and we deal with both. And we also deal with these iconic figures. We bring them back. We treat Berek Yoselevich, for example, as an historical figure when we present the story of the partitions and the uprisings. But we bring him back as an iconic figure of the, if you will, the perfect Jew. And the same with Yankiel and with other Bermeisels and other of these iconic figures. So the critical perspective is there as a fundamental part of the historical of our historical narration. It's there. Here, it's too soon. They don't have enough context. What kind of critical reflection are we going to do in this forest in the first 10 seconds that they've entered the exhibition? We can't do it here. I wouldn't even want to do it here. I would rather for there to be a resonance that when they get to the 19th century gallery and they come up to these integrationists, that maybe they'll reflect back on the stories that they encountered here. So it rather would be like a retrospect than a prospect, and keep them here, if you will, in the mentality of the story itself. And that's something else that we try to do, is to actually try to really get our visitors to think, first of all, in the terms in which those who are speaking thought, felt, and experienced, and then bring a critical perspective to it. But if you only have the critical perspective, there's a way in which the reality of those stories for those who told them kind of becomes an epiphenomenon. You sense, in a sense, you lose the immediacy of the historic moment. So we have a somewhat different approach, but definitely critical perspective is essential. And I've had one of my, Marcin Wojcinski is one of our key historians, wonderful historian from Wrocław University, and he's actually quite uncomfortable with these legends of arrival. Oh, they're apologetic, they're 19th century, they're romantic, you know, et cetera. So I think that they work here. But I agree with you that a critical perspective is absolutely essential. It's a good point. Thanks.
Nie ma więcej pytań. Dziękujemy pani profesor Barbarze Kirschenblatt-Gimblett za ten piękny wykład. Dziękujemy państwu za pytania, za tak liczne przybycie. I zapraszamy na następny wykład cyklu odsłony wystawy głównej 9 grudnia. Profesor Hanna Zaremska przedstawi koncepcję galerii średniowiecznej.
And I have also would like to encourage you to come at 8 o'clock. There's a very, very nice film. And it's a preview of this film. It's Jesteśmy Tu. And it's a film about, it follows five stories of Jews living in Poland today and their personal stories. And it's made by a Canadian filmmaker, and it will be in Polish and English with subtitles. And we're showing it in the auditorium at 8 o'clock this evening, and it's free of charge. And you would be most, most welcome to come. And I think it would be a very nice counterpoint to the forest. So.